Mr. President, America's involvement in Vietnam was regarded by many as a disaster. It was splitting American society at home in a very grievous way for what seemed to many an obscure or even a mistaken reason. How did it look to you, though?
Well, it looked to me first that the reason for our being in Vietnam had perhaps not been adequately understood by the American people. I thought first that Kennedy and Johnson were right in going in Vietnam. I was very critical of the way the war had been conducted. I thought they could have done, particularly President Johnson, because, of course, he had the major responsibility. We were in deeper by the time he was president, that they could have conducted it in a more effective way. I had some ideas as to what could be done, but I wasn't about to go down that easy political path of bugging out, blaming it on my predecessors. It would have been enormously popular in America, but that would have paid, had been at an enormous cost, eventually even to America, but particularly to the whole free world.
But wasn't staying there, I mean, that was also at a massive cost, wasn't it, in billions of dollars, in 138,000 South Vietnamese killed, half a million Cambodians, half a million North Vietnamese, and so on. That cost, it's a question of weighing one cost against another cost, isn't it? But you thought that cost was worth paying for what you got.
It was worth it in terms of the period in which I had the responsibility. Let me be quite candid about it. The most popular position to take in Vietnam, if I was simply playing to the votes and playing to popular opinion in the world, was to bug out and blame it on Johnson and Kennedy.
I know.
And I didn't do it. Now, the most popular position for me to take now is to say the whole venture in Vietnam, everything that we did, was a waste of men, that it showed the United States at its worst. It cost us a great deal of money. We were morally wrong to be there, go there in the first place, morally wrong to continue it as long as we did, and it wasn't worth it. And I could say that. And many, perhaps, of those, and that's probably a majority of our viewers who agree with that, might applaud, even some of my critics, who, many of whom I have, and many of whom I have earned. But I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say it because I don't believe it. I don't believe that this was a war that I can tote up the advantages and disadvantages and say overwhelmingly this is a war that had to be fought and that we had a successful outcome. I can't say that because it was a very complex situation. It was complex at the beginning. It was difficult throughout. I know what Johnson went through and how he agonized over the war.
Now, what was the first thing or the first things, what were the first things that you did then to try and solve the problem of the Vietnam War?
As far as my ideas as to how we could bring the war to an end, we had what I would call a three-track policy. One, we should continue to negotiate and try to find some new formula that would bring the two parties together. Two, we should combine that, if negotiations reached a dead end or a roadblock, with increased military pressure, because we felt that with increased military pressure that might help. But the third leg of this three-legged stool, as far as the strategy was concerned, was to go to the heart of the problem. Without Soviet arms, the North Vietnamese would not have been able to wage a successful war against South Vietnam.
Did the Russians not try and influence the North Vietnamese, or were the North Vietnamese genuinely independent of the Russians?
Well, the Russians told us that they couldn't influence them. We didn't take that at face value. We couldn't. After all, they could have influenced them by cutting down on the flow of arms to them. And Their words, therefore, had a very hollow ring.
And then on April the 30th, you stunned the public by announcing this armed incursion into Cambodia. And everybody that we've talked to has said that, or claimed that they know of people or they advised against the military effectiveness of this particular. People at the Pentagon say they didn't think this would be effective. People at the NSC said they said it didn't think it would be effective. People at the CIA said they had a report proving it wouldn't be effective and so on. I wonder on whose advice you decided to do it.
Well, first let's answer the question of whether they were right. They were totally wrong. As a result of that sanctuary movement, we picked up, apart from the casualties inflicted on the enemy, and they were substantial, but there were 22,000 rifles. There were 15 million rounds of ammunition, a whole year's supply, 150,000 rockets and mortars, 14 months of supply, rice, other equipment, and the rest. And as a result of that operation, our casualties went down. We were able to continue and eventually to step up our withdrawal program from Vietnam. It was one of the most effective operations of the war.
You mentioned the list of achievements of that particular armed incursion. I presume that you'd agree that really the one thing that you'd been hoping for that it was discovered didn't exist was the thing you said the attack was directed against the headquarters for the entire communist military operation in South Vietnam, which sort of made it sound like a sort of Dr. No's palace or a bamboo pentagon somewhere in Cambodia. We were to discover that there was no such place as that.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, our intelligence, CIA intelligence, was not at its best in that area. This is not said in terms of criticism of men trying to do a good job under difficult circumstances, but they just didn't have the way to find it out. I mean, like the coup, the La No coup, we had no advance notice whatever of that. We didn't know anything about it. The CIA apparently had agents. We assume that they would either, they may not have had agents, but they must have had some informants. And as far as the intelligence in this case is concerned, it was not particularly adequate.
On the subject of Cambodia, let me put a philosophical thought to you, which I put to you particularly in a sense as a Quaker, in the sense that a lot of the philosophical studies that I've read of Cambodia and this little nation that started with perhaps 6,000 members of the Khmer Rouge and a population of 7 million and neutrality or flawed neutrality, that nevertheless, with that flawed neutrality, was somehow surviving in the midst of a Holocaust. And the concatenation of events that the administration were involved in, starting with the bombing, the armed incursion, the driving of people, the North Vietnamese and others back across Cambodia, the continued bombing and twice the tonnage we dropped on North Vietnam, that all of this embroiled this little country in a Holocaust. It started with this flawed neutrality, and it ended up at the end of this whole saga with more than 500,000 dead. There were more dead later when the Khmer Rouge took over, but that this bringing them up into the Holocaust created the Khmer Rouge and destroyed a country that might otherwise have survived, and that we, therefore, do you have, in a Quaker sense, on your conscience, the destruction of this rather pitiful country?
If I could accept your assumption, yes, but I cannot accept your assumption. I don't accept it because I know the facts. I think I know the facts, at least. I do know that without United States assistance, that instead of having a situation as we have it today, in which Cambodia is not neutral, in which Cambodia is one of the most ruthless, cruel, vicious communist dictatorships in the world. 500,000, according to the New York Times, not a particularly one to find such atrocities in such areas in, as Cambodia. 500,000 dead, 1.5 million off to relocation centers. The country is in pitiful shape. But for 5 years, from 1970 to 1975, Cambodia enjoyed, for whatever we may call it, or at least had, enjoyed is not the best word. It had what you call a flawed neutrality. But as far as that neutrality was concerned, yes, during that five-year period, lives were lost. But on the other hand, as far as this savage, cruel, virtual extermination of a people that has taken place, of a class of people since the communists took over, they avoided that. And yes, that was worth something.
In these difficult years, America has suffered from a fever of words, from inflated rhetoric that promises more than it can deliver, from angry rhetoric that fans discontents into hatreds, from bombastic rhetoric that postures instead of persuading. We cannot learn from one another until we stop shouting at one another, until we speak quietly enough so that our words can be heard as well as our voices.
But many Americans were not inclined to speak quietly so long as the war in Indochina continued. And within a year, the rhetoric of the president had taken on a different tone.
Those who carry a peace sign in one hand and throw a bomb or a brick with the other are the super hypocrites of our time. For too long, we have appeased aggression here at home, and as with all appeasement, the result has been more aggression and more violence. The time has come to draw the line. The time has come for the great silent majority of Americans of all ages, of every political persuasion, to stand up and be counted against appeasement of the rock throwers and the obscenity shouters in America.
Now, where in between those two dates did you, would you put the Damascus moment when you realized that all hope of speaking quietly and bringing everybody together was hopeless, and that in fact you had a war on your hands at home as well? When was the moment when in effect you said, okay, no more Mr. Nice Guy?
I would say that after having met you at Midway and started the process of withdrawal, after having made a speech in May, making a very generous offer to the North Vietnamese and also to the Viet Cong for a peace settlement and to negotiate on some reasonable terms, when in spite of those efforts and our efforts to bring the war to a peaceful conclusion as quickly as possible, there continued to be a rising tide, not just of dissent, peaceful dissent, that's one thing, but dissent coupled with violence and advocacy of violence. Then I had to make a choice. Are we going to allow this group to first, where they were violence prone, to endanger the lives of others within, but second, even more important, are we going to allow our potential enemies, those that we were negotiating with in Paris, gain the impression that they represent a majority? In other words, are we going to have a situation where this war would be lost in Washington as the French lost in 1954 in Paris rather than in Dien Bien Phu.
And so when did you make that decision that you had to speak back, that you had to rally your own support?
So I made that decision before November 3rd. I decided I had to mobilize what I thought was the majority in the country. I couldn't be sure. It was a big gamble.
Let me try and just draw some of these themes together.
Sure.
And put an alternative scenario, in a sense, to use one of your words. That is that, as we've talked about the politics of polarization and so on, there are a great many people who really feel that there were two stages, really, that there was the stage of when knowing that to continue the war would also continue dissent, and that you had to answer back to your critics, and that you and Vice President Agnew answered back with full force and more, that in fact the decision to continue with the war divided America, that you saw the divisions that had divided America into two groups, the Eastern establishment and the minority groups in the media, versus the Middle America, the patriotic Southerners, and the urban ethnic groups, etc.
And a lot of decent people too.
Sure. I mean,
even though they may not have gone to college.
Right. And that you saw those divisions, and that you realized that the war would continue with dissent, continue with a divided America. And that also, wherever you could in other policies, you tried to build that group that were your support, play to them politically to increase your majority in 72. And that the result was that an America that was already divided, you divided even more on a principle of that the only way is to divide and rule.
You can make that charge, and I don't say that in any personal sense. You can make it, and you should, because a lot of your constituency in the media do think that. But they're wrong. In my view, I had a responsibility, which was above everything else, to bring that war to the earliest possible conclusion, and I did it. And we got it finished, and we got it finished on what I would say, again, was an honorable basis, and a peace that lasted for at least over two years.
The wave of dissent, occasionally violent, which followed in the wake of the Cambodian incursion, prompted President Nixon to demand better intelligence about the people who were opposing him. To this end, the Deputy White House Counsel, Tom Houston, arranged a series of meetings with representatives of the CIA, the FBI, and other police and intelligence agencies. These meetings produced a plan, the Houston Plan, which advocated the systematic use of wiretappings, burglaries or so-called black bag jobs, mail openings, and infiltration against anti-war groups and others. Some of these activities, as Houston emphasized to Nixon, were clearly illegal. Nevertheless, the president approved the plan. 5 days later, after opposition from J. Edgar Hoover, the plan was withdrawn, but the president's approval was later to be listed in the articles of impeachment as an alleged abuse of presidential power. Now, when you were concerned about street crime and so on, you went to Congress and got laws passed and so on. Wouldn't it have been better
Much
here?
Too late.
Wouldn't it have been better here, though, to have done what you were going to do legally rather than doing something that was illegal? I mean, seizing evidence in this way and all of that. In retrospect, wouldn't it have been better to combat that crime legally rather than adding another crime to the list?
Basically, the proposition you've just stated, in theory, is perfect. In practice, it just won't work. To get legislation, specific legislation, to have warrantless entries for the purpose of obtaining information and the rest, would not only have raised an outcry, but it would have made it terribly difficult to move in on these organizations, because basically they would be put on notice by the very fact that the legislation was on the books, that they'd be potential targets. And action's either going to be covert or not.
So what, in a sense, you're saying is that there are certain situations, and the Houston plan or that part of it was one of them, where the president can decide that it's in the best interest of the nation or something, and do something illegal.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
By definition.
Exactly. Exactly. If the president, for example, the president approves something, approves an action because of the national security, or in this case, because of a threat to internal peace and order of a significant magnitude, then the president's decision in that instance is one that enables those who carry it out to carry it out without violating the law. Otherwise, they're in an impossible position.
But so that, just so we understand this, equally it would apply, presumably, these burglaries that we were talking about, that the people would not be open to criminal prosecution at the end. Equally, it would, in the theoretical case where the action ordered by the president was a murder, it would also apply, presumably.
No,
would the presidential shield also protect the murderer?
No, because I don't know anybody who has been president or is now who would ever have ordered such
no,
an
no,
action.
No,
and I haven't.
Nor,
the
do,
Houston
I, nor
plan,
do I have evidence
and
of that
the Houston
either.
Plan, and the Houston plan, as you know, is very carefully worded in terms of how limited it is to be.
No, but all I was saying was, where do we draw the line? If you're saying that presidential fiat can, in fact, mean that someone who does one of these black bag jobs, these burglaries, is not liable to criminal prosecution, why shouldn't the same presidential power apply to somebody who the president feels in the national interest should murder a dissenter? Now, I'm not saying it's happened. I'm saying, what's the dividing line between the burglar not being liable to criminal prosecution and the murderer? Or
because,
is there one?
Because, as you know from many years of studying and covering the world of politics and political science, there are degrees, there are nuances, which are difficult to explain, but which are there. As far as this particular matter is concerned, each case has to be considered on its merits.